I'm really honored, first of all, to be here because being a Christian, number one, has been important in my life. I grew up in a home where my mother and father taught my brother, sister, and I the importance of our Christian, our Catholic religion, in my case specifically. But I love, you know, obviously, Jesus has been very important in my life, and I think it's great here that you people are honoring people that are more than just athletes. I think one thing that's really has really frustrated me over the years is that a lot of athletes, unfortunately, forget about where they come from once they make it to the top of the mountain. Not all. I mean, I can tell you all the great ones, David Robinson and Derek Jeter and Grant Hills, and I could go on and on with a lot of great ones. But there are some, and just so sad with what happens to them when they get the dollars and they get the entourage, etc. Now, Jesus Christ has been big to me in my life, specifically, and I'll share that out there. I lost my eye as a kid. And I thought it was the end of the world. I really did. I thought it was, you know, where are you going with your life now? You're going nowhere. I was like a little kid at the time. But as I'll tell the crowd, I came from an incredible home life. My mother and father were as good as it can be. Blue collar all the way, factory workers, fifth grade education, never really education wasn't part of our life. I mean, my mother had nine brothers and sisters, and my father had nine brothers and sisters. And as of about a year ago, they're all gone. And I remember we just celebrated Easter, and I was telling my daughters had a party at one of my girls' homes, and we went there, and at 11 of us, and I said, you know, this is unbelievable. There's nothing like family, and I miss so much. We used to have gatherings on Easter and Christmas with family that you could not even imagine. They were the most fun because all my uncles and all my aunts, though uneducated, every one of them, like my mom and dad, had a doctrinal love. They were all about their family. They were all about doing the right thing, going out working, busting their gut. My father pressed coats in a factory. My mother sewed coats. And then they would run them over to my father and a sweatshop like you couldn't believe. I mean, that's work. But they inspired me. They encouraged me, and the two things I'll share with the crowd, I share it in my book. My mom and dad constantly would tell me, never was Dick Ritchie. Don't ever, ever believe in can't, number one, and number two, be good to people, and people will be good to you. And that's kind of the theory and the doctrine that I've lived my life with. I get so many times today, a guy asked me earlier this morning, like, where do you get that energy, man? I can't believe it. You're 77, you act like 12. Well, whenever you do something you love, as I tell young kids, if you have a passion in which I've never worked, really, what's my work? Oh, today you're going to do Kansas West Virginia. Tomorrow you're going to do Duke and such and such. You're going to do Kentucky and Florida. Sitting there in the best seat in place. People treat you like royalty. The minute you walk in, they can't do enough for you. You're going to sit down and you're going to call a game featuring the best players. My boss, I always tell him, you're the dumbest guys in the world, man. Because if you know this, I'd do this for nothing. But you know what? I like the check they sent me. Any questions or anything? I'm giving my speech. That was a good rehearsal, though. I could tell Brian's passion, and I love that. I love people that have a passion about what they're doing. I don't like when I go to work, you know, whenever we do a telecast, there's loads of people involved. It's not just the play-by-play guy and me. There's camera people. There's graphics operators. And then they'll occasionally run into somebody moaning and groaning and complaining, and I just want no time for that, really. I you don't like what you're doing, then get another job. I mean, seriously. Well, I love what I'm doing. I love what I'm doing. I love people. I always look at the glass as half filled, not half empty, and I'm hoping that phone rings with some good results. I'm hoping I'm talking to you. My mind is wandering here. But anyway, any questions?
Dick, I got to ask you, because to a whole generation, you've been on television and done all this stuff, but you had a whole other career before this that a lot of people don't remember, and then that fact you coached for many, many years. I mean, how do you put that in perspective, that the balance of your life has been spent in a career that you really didn't start out doing?
Well, you know, I started at 21, 22. I got into coaching, and I loved that too. I loved it. A lot of people don't realize this. I taught for about 10 years, sixth, seventh grade. I get letters a lot of times from former students, and they'll write and they'll say, hey, our kids don't believe us that you were our teacher. We try to tell them that. And I'll write back, hey, don't be like your father, man. But anyway, again, I loved what I was doing. I was coaching junior high, basketball, baseball, football. I didn't know a thing about football. I was just at a big event at Vince Dooley. I was honored. I received an award about a week ago, yeah. The Wooden Cup Citizenship Award. And it's named after a man that meant a great deal to me, John Wooden, because he believed in all the principles and characteristics that I do. And when they called me, they told me I was the recipient, and I looked at the previous winners. I said, something wrong with this, man. Jack Nicklaus, Peyton Manning, a Calvin Ripken, Pat Summitt, and Dick Vitale. I don't belong in that, Louie. But the situation, you know, it was just, as I told Coach Dooley, he was in the crowd. I says, he's a Hall of Famer, Georgia. I says, Coach, I want you to know this. I knew nothing about football. I don't know split tees. I don't know wing tees. I don't know wideouts. I don't know any of that stuff. But I knew one thing. If they got six when I coached junior high football, we better come away with seven. And fortunately, we're 18 and up. But then I reached a point. I reached a point in my career where I said, if you want to advance as a coach, you're not going to have coach baseball. We went to the we won a state championship at an AAU baseball team, and it was called the Triple ABA, and we played up in Johnstown in the Nationals. And I went out and recruited all the best players in our county, and they all played. It was 16 to 19, and we really good. And I loved baseball. I still love baseball. But then I sat there and I assessed my career, and I said, look. You're not going anywhere in baseball as a coach because you never played in a minor leagues, major leagues. And if you don't play at that level, you're not going to advance as a professional coach. You're just not going to do it. And I looked football. I didn't know enough football. I knew how to motivate people. I knew how to inspire, but I didn't know enough technically. But I said, basketball, I did research. You can really advance if you go out to clinics and you study the game, you learn it. And that's what I did. I put all my attention. And then one day, the phone rang. And it rang, and guy, a caller on the other end used to see me a lot because I used to get, you know, wasn't the greatest student in the world. I'm not proud to say that, but he was the principal at a high school where I went to school, East Rutherford. And he called me, I was Richie, you know, I'm the superintendent now at the school. He said, I've been following you. I see you're coaching junior high, and you're over there in Garfield, New Jersey. What about coming home to East Rutherford, your school? He said, we got an opening in basketball, but I have to be very honest with you, he said. Nobody wants the job. You got a 60 by 40 gym to practice in. We have no real tradition. He said, but if you want it, it's yours. I said, are you kidding me? I said, do I want it? I said, of course I want to be a head coach. And I went there, and we were a football power. And my first year, our first team meeting, I looked at the kids, I said, I'm going to win now. We're going to win now. I'm going to win tomorrow, and next day, we're going to win. You got to believe you can win. And we went out, and we won the state sectional championship. And then we won two state championships my last 2 years in the state, and then I got a chance to go to college. But that was my start, and I stayed, and I put all my attention to basketball. In a matter of 7 years, a lot of people don't know this, 1970, I'm teaching the sixth grade, coaching in high school, we win a state championship. 71, I'm assistant coach at Rutgers University. We get really fortunate and recruit some great players, the best recruiting class ever in the history of the university. And if you look it up, they went, that group, to the Final Four. They lost, Indiana was there, Michigan, UCLA, and Rutgers. But because of that, I got the University of Detroit head job. And my career just exploded. In 7 years, it went from sixth grade, 7 years later, I'm coaching in the NBA. My math's not good. Let me think. I'm coaching the NBA in 70, was it, Lorraine? 77? 70, 78, 78. So 78, 130. I was 38, 39 years old, and I went from the sixth grade to the NBA. I'm sitting on the bench, and I'm looking down the end. I'm coaching against Jerry West. I'm saying, geez, can I get an autograph going down the And Jerry West, I can't believe it. I'm looking across and we playing the game, and there's Dr. J dunking on us. I'm saying, this is not like East Rutherford High School, man. Kareem Abdul, I was just yesterday. She was there. I'm on the phone yesterday with one of my former great players, I mean, you guys probably all know the name, Hall of Famer, Bob Lanier. Bob Lanier was a terrific center. Unfortunately for me, he suffered some knees. Bob had a number of knee operations. And we're playing the Lakers. I told Bob this last night. He's laughing his head off. Bob's sitting next to me. He's got this expensive, beautiful suit on. Sitting next to me, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is dunking, driving, skyhooks, killing us. And Bob whispers over. I never forget, he whispers, "Hey, Dick, I really finally figured out our problem." I said, "Really? What's our problem?" He said, "We got no inside game." I said, "No kidding. My inside game's sitting right here next to me, paying a lot of money, but he's not injured." And anyway, you know, I got fired. I got fired my second year. I got fired because of me. The owner had no other choice but to fire me, really. He was a beautiful guy. I loved him dearly, treated me very fairly. But my wife kept saying to me, she said, "You can't keep telling the owner that you can't win. You can't win, because eventually it's going to wear them down." And one night, the night before I got fired, it was November 7th, I got fired November 8th, you remember the day, because my career, like I said, was exploding. And all of a sudden, she tells me after I got off the phone, she said, "You're going to get fired tomorrow. You can't talk to the owner like that." I didn't get nasty with her or nothing, but I just simply said, "Mr. Davidson, I'm going to tell you again, we cannot win with what we're doing. And the way we're operating, we have no general manager, we have nothing, I mean, this is not going to get done. I know you're a beautiful man," but I said, he said, "Dick," he said, when he came over the next day, and she was right, she went around the block, she said, when he came over with the limo, she said, "I'm going to go around the block, but you better prepare yourself, he's not coming in the house just to talk to you, you're getting fired." And I said, "You're out of your mind." So like 10, 12 games into the season, and we're like, I don't know, 4-7, 5-7, or 4, whatever. And I said, "No way." And she says, "I'm telling you, you can't keep telling him what you did. Prepare yourself." So he walks in. He's a very low-key guy. I mean, terrific. Heart of gold, would give you his back. I mean, do anything. He gave millions and millions to University of Michigan, his alma mater. He gives millions to his Jewish faith, to his charities and different events. He's just just a great guy. And he says to me, sat down very low key, he said, "I hate to do what I'm doing." He said, "I have no choice," just like that. He said, "I have no choice." He whispered, he doesn't speak loud, he's very low key. And he said, "I have to make a coaching change, Dick. You're your biggest enemy. I told you 5 million times, we didn't expect to win right away. We think it's a 5-year deal. You're not patient. And that's the problem. I've never been patient. I've never been the kind of guy, even when I told you about the high school, I wasn't going to accept that we're going to lose and we're going to build. I'm going to build now. We're going to go out and get players." University of Detroit, I came in, they kept telling me, "You're not going to get people. You're not going to." So I was used to always going places and winning. And then all of a sudden, man, you could coach. And I told them, "I could coach till I'm blue in the face. You're not beating Dr. J, and you're not beating Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. You can put any coaches you want there with the personnel we were playing. You just have no chance, no chance." You were changing coaches left and right. Ray Scott, Donis Butcher, I mean, it goes on, Herb Brown, and changing. You got to get a general manager. And sure enough, they did. The one thing, when I got fired, he wanted me to be an executive and higher in the office and all that jazz, VPs, titles. I said, "No, I'm 30s. I want to get back coaching where I belong in college." I said, "I thank you so much." I mean, I cried. I'll be honest. I cried like a baby. I was just like, and then it was a learning experience. And again, my faith in Jesus Christ and my faith, I prayed and really changed my life, because I really found out a lot about people. I'll give an example. There was a fellow, we go to church on Sunday. And after church, they always have, you know, coffees and donuts and, you know, toast or whatever. You just go there, they talk with people and you have a good time. Well, all of a sudden, I get fired and I go to church that Sunday, and a guy who was, I used to get him tickets all the time to come over to the house, autograph basketballs from players, NBA, and like I was the bubonic plague. I mean, he wouldn't even come over and say hello. Finally, the second time I went over to him, second week, in a nice way, I said, "Man," I says, "I'm Dick Vitale, just a regular citizen like everybody else, but you don't want to know me anymore. because that doesn't say NBA head coach. And he was a good guy. He's not, to be honest with you, I just felt funny coming over to you, because I know it probably hurt you. So he was good about it. But the point I'm making, my phone, I call people up. You don't get no return calls except from your family and from your real, real people close to you. So it was a great learning experience.
Oh, this may be the hardest question you get, because I know you have tons of funny stories that you relate, because I've heard a lot of them. But you're, as far as being a cultural icon, which is what you are, I mean, you're an American treasure. They're college students.
I want to make you my PR man.
That's a hard group of people to impress, college students, and yet, I mean, they all love you. Everybody loves you. Well, of all the things that...
They're not even going to love me. I'll tell you, some people out there, you know, whenever you're different, and I'm certainly different, I'm not your, you know, you're well, good looking, smooth. I mean, sometimes I wish I was that smooth, good looking broadcaster you see on TV. I'm just me, man. I look at that light. When we have production meetings, our people before games and all, they look at me and they'll say, I don't know why we just spent an hour and a half. Once you get on the camera, you're going to do what you want. You're going to say what you want. But that's what's made me. That's what's made me, you know, popular with a lot of kids. And you're right about one thing. It gives me goosebumps at age 77 to walk in an arena and the kids are chanting your name and Dickie V, coming over, pictures, huh? You know, I keep hearing about, you know, the people of all ages. I mean, a bunch of little kids, and they're just my wife's not listening, but the other day, a bunch of little kids coming over. Hey, Dickie V, can we get pictures? Can we get autographs? You know, I've never had a problem relating to people, whether it be black, white, rich, poor, because I've always felt if you're honest and you're upfront and you look them in the eye and you do things the right way, they'll respond to you. But yeah, it really is a great thrill for me at my age. I don't know how long it's going to go. I really don't. But I do know this. My boss came to my home about, well, it was the day before the national, when it was the National Football Championship. When was that? January?
Yeah.
Somewhere in January. Yeah. The day before, I live in the Sarasota, Bradenton area in Tampa. The football game was in Tampa. He called me up and he said to me, John Skipper, the president of ESPN, he said, I really would love to get together for dinner with you and Lorraine. And I didn't know Mr. Skipper as well as I knew the other presidents. George Bodenheim and I have been very close. I was on the board of the V Foundation. Anyway, he came over and he said, I would like to spend some time. So he came over to my house and we're walking around, we're talking. And finally, we said, let's go to dinner. And we went to dinner. And we sat there and he said, I want to tell you this. He said, I want you to know that when I got the job of your president, George Bodenheimer, my predecessor, gave me a list of items that he wanted me to make sure I enforced. And one of them was to make sure Dickie V has a job for life. And I got choked up. You know, he said, Dick, you call us when you can't work or you don't want to work. He said, but you got a job with us for life. And that is a tremendous feeling as a person. Really, and especially you guys are in the broadcasting business, journalist business, it's so subjective as to what people think. Somebody thinks this guy's great, somebody thinks this guy. I am so proud to know that I've gone through, I don't know how many presidents, 38 years I've been here. I'll take to my grave that I did the very first game in the history of the network. No, December 5, 1979, that was my first game. And if you would have told me that I'd be sitting here today, 38 years later, and still working here, I'd say you're crazy. But it's worked out. They're my second family. The number one priority in my life is my family, and then my second family is ESPN.
What's your funniest thing, though, of all? I mean, we remember the invitations where you had a contest of people imitating Dickie V.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm sure in airports you get stopped all the time.
Oh, my God.
In arenas you get stopped all the time. And I know this is a hard
question. About 6 in the morning? What about on a plane sitting in what about doing an event, and the event ends late, you go out with some people, and now you got a 6 a.m. Wake-up call, 5 a.m., but you got to get to the airport in Atlanta. I remember sitting in a first class in the first seat in a corner. I'm sitting there like this, and guy comes walking on and he says, wait a minute, Dickie V, I don't see no life out of you, man. You're on TV, you look like you have dead. I said, man, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. I said, what do you want me to do? I said, you want me to yell, awesome, baby? And I'll get, when I go to the airport, you know, Skycaps, those guys coming over. Hey, come on, am I a PTP or am I awesome, baby? Do I need a TO, baby? But I laugh, you know, it's a great feeling. It really is that people care. But the most important thing to me is my family, and I want to just hope and pray that they will do well, and my grandkids and my daughters, my two girls have made me so proud of my life. Both my girls went to University of Notre Dame, and I couldn't spell Notre Dame. I was so dumb. They went to the University of Notre Dame. I told Lou Holtz had me speak. He calls me, I'm the surprise speaker. They're playing a big game. I think it might have been Michigan. I don't remember who. But they want me to do the pep rally. 14,000 people. And my daughter calls me up and she says, hey, Dad, the word is that you're going to be the surprise speaker at our big pep rally. I said, no, I was trying to be serious. No, where'd you hear that? Oh, no. I said, I'm not sure. I'm trying to tell a little white fib. So anyway, he calls me up to speak. And that's only Lou could do. He goes, hey, we got Dickie V. He's going to be my surprise speaker today. He's got a brain like Einstein. He's been dead since 1955. I said, thanks, Lou. I come here for nothing. I do you a favor. And you're roasting me. But I'm proud. Both my girls went back to Notre Dame, got their master's, married two quality guys from Notre Dame. They both were athletes. My daughters were tennis players. That's why their grandkids play tennis. No results yet? Oh, gee, that's a bad sign. That's a bad sign. There's no results yet. So anyway, you know, she married the quarterback in football. He was a quarterback there.